Do you have something you want to ask me? Go ahead.
Well, I come from a different lineage.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just trying to
yes,
understand
compare.
Where the concept is.
Right. Okay, I can give you a little bit of background if you like. So there are sort of four phases in the history of Buddhism. And the first one is the Buddha himself, 2,600 years ago. And for about almost 800 years, what he taught was passed on verbally, and people practiced. And then in about 400 AD, and I find this interesting, there is a man who lives in Sri Lanka, who I know and I've met, who has recall of being a monk 400 AD, who could recount by because he could learn, he learned suttas, the teachings of the Buddha recorded as suttas, because in 400 AD they began to be written down. And he remembers being one of the monks who could recite so well that he was asked to recite while it was being written down. He even you hear him on YouTube, 1.5-year-old, he's 40-something now. You can hear, if you look chanting monk up, you'll hear this 1.5-year-old boy, his father had the foresight to take him. Didn't know what he was doing and ended up hitting him because he couldn't stand that he went on making all this racket. And it wasn't till he was 7 or something that a monk listened and heard him, by which time he could chant 4 hours without repeating himself, old Pali. And he remembered that he had such, if you, this is one of the most convincing cases I know of reincarnation. Because he was repeating, even at 1.5, he could go for 22 minutes chanting and no one knew what he was doing in his family. And he was able to, they were driving in the car when he was 8. I've heard him tell this story, with a family. And he got all excited because they were in a different part of Sri Lanka than he lived. And he was like, go over this way, go down this lane, go across this field, go over here. And then he said, stop, stop, and jumped out. And there were all these kind of like bumps in the field. And he said, this is where I lived. This was the bedroom. This was the meditation hall. This was the bathhouse. And they excavated and did a hole. And they discovered a monastery there from 400 AD. He had lived in it, and that's where he had been written down what he was able to chant. And so, why was I telling all this? So that was in the time that the sort of formula of Theravada formed around the time, because it started being written down. There was sort of structure to the Buddha's teachings, because it was all by a man called Buddhaghosa, who was a scholar, who was interested in doing this, and thank God for him. Although he wasn't a practitioner himself, he was not a very nice man, according to the monk who was the chanting guy. Who teaches Vipassana, that's how I met him, because he's a teacher. Anyhow, so that was the beginning of Theravada, sort of the formulaic teachings of the Buddha. Around the same time, the practitioners had practiced long and hard in all their lives, and so the formula that began and was then sort of codified around that time was extremely detailed about different, 52 different emotional states and different psychological states and lots of great detail. And people, younger people, wanted more sort of, they just wanted awakening. They didn't want to have to be a monk for the last 25, 35 years of their life and discover all these incredibly complicated, subtle, nuanced states of mind, which had developed because of the years of practicing, but not what the Buddha taught. And so there was a rebellion against the strictures and the detail of Theravada. In the form of Mahayana, which was the birth of instant realization right here and now, and more magical thinking and less formulaic structured teachings, and much more the possibility of making merit. If I, wish well for the world and I practice sincerely and I go on my knees and round Mount Kailash, I'll be enlightened and I don't have to meditate for the whole life. Sort of there's a bit of a reaction against the sort of some of the stodginess that had developed over the years of Theravada, which isn't the teachings of the Buddha, it's the formula. So that was the birth of Mahayana, somewhere in there, 500 or 600 AD. And then it wasn't till about 1100 AD that some Indian monk, Akosha, actually made it into Tibet, which was, impossible to get to, as it was so far away and so high and so mountainous, and married with the religion of Tibet, which had been a long-established bun, very animistic, spirits in everywhere, everything, very colorful, religion, and so that was the birth of Vajrayana, which is a sort of combination of Bun and Buddhism. So it's a much more, that's why all the color and all the, you know, recitations and visualizations and all, it's like kind of submerging. It wasn't, again, what the Buddha taught, so it's quite far from what the Buddha taught. The basic principles, there is suffering, and we can end suffering because it's all going on in our minds if we train our minds. It's all the same, whatever the traditions. And then with the Mahayana became Zen. It went through China and got quite established. It changed different things with other religions in China, but through the Korean Peninsula and Japan, it became really the religion of that land and those lands, and it took on the form of the societies, which is very militaristic and precise and simple in Japan's whole way, cultural way. And so that's what we've got in the West, is that Zen is from the Mahayana, you know, Tibetan chanting and visualizations and all from that, and then Theravada. But we also have a sort of a revival at the moment in Theravada, before Theravada was a religion, the teachings of the Buddha, just the suttas of the Buddha. So there are scholars, Christina Feldman is one of those I know, and some scholar monks who have been able to study the Pali language enough that they're actually simply teaching what was taught by the Buddha, as best we know from the teachings, from the suttas. So sutta, early Buddhism, they call themselves. So this early Buddhism that became the formulaic Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana.
So where does Vipassana?
Vipassana is another, is insight. And a lot of people have, because the West, it came out of Theravada, but Theravada has been this mix between early Buddhism and then some of the more formulaic stuff. So some of the interpreters of Theravada, for instance, the people who are really interested in the Visuddhimagga, which was the written down term, very, very fine detail, very complex. And some of the monks are very assiduous about, you have to study all these detailed pieces. And one of the most famous monks from Burma is Upandita from Mahasi. He was a student of Mahasi Sayadaw, who's very into the Visuddhimagga and all these structural details. But a lot of the people who came to the West and taught it didn't bring so much of the complexity, and they just brought the practices, which is more a reflection of what the Buddha taught from earlier. So Vipassana is both that, but it's not, and it's not Tibetan Vajrayana, it's before that. It's closer to what the Buddha actually taught. And the Buddha wasn't a religious guy. He was just a human being who saw his mind. It was much more a psychological shift, and he saw that his mind caused distress, and his mind could see things differently and not be so caught. And so he just was a practical teacher of that. So he didn't have, he wasn't a Buddhist. A Christian.
My answer.
Yeah.
And then there's the Goenka.
Yeah, that's one of the Vipassana teachers.
Right, so those, that's one that's more strict compared to, say, Joseph.
Yeah, they're different. As the years have gone by, people have gone to study with different teachers. And it's only apparently in the last, now it'll be 35 years or so, 40 years at the most, that in Burma, so Thailand. You're interested in all this. You're interested in this?
Yeah.
So in Thailand, the practice has been much more traditionally an integrated practice in living, and a living of generosity and a living of embodied awareness, that kind of thing, with a lot of folklore trust in potions and ritual and chanting. In Burma, more was, for some reason, I don't know how it just happened. I don't know enough about this. I've not traveled there a lot, so I'm not a big authority, but as best I can tell you, is Burma, there were certain monks, certain abbots of monasteries, who all the meditation was just by monastics in monasteries in Burma for a long, long time. And so if you wanted to actually really practice anything, you had to go and be a monk. A lot of people did for a period of time. It was common. Even a nun, but there was a very second-class thing about women. Mostly you're doing the housework. But then about 50 years ago or something, some of the monks, the abbots, decided that actually lay people could come. Mahasi Sayadaw being the main one. Lay people could come and learn practice. They didn't have to be a monastic. So it began to open up into the laity for the first time. And so then they built meditation centers behind their, attached to or behind their monasteries for lay people to come and do intensive meditation training. So they then got very intensive, and they got some really, really detailed structure, which never happened in Thailand. It was just live it in Thailand, live awareness. I don't know so much about Sri Lanka, and I'd like to know more how they did it in Sri Lanka. What were the difference? So there's a different style, a style that's the Thai style. The most famous teacher in our common era being Ajahn Chah, the student of his being Jack Kornfield, is more the sort of open and wet live. It's an awareness of how you're living, how you're speaking, how you're interacting, how you're relating, the way you're judging people and all of that. Whereas in Burma, Upandita was like detail, Mahasi side, and the Visuddhimagga style, like much more subtle, deep concentration states and so on. And only in the last 35 or so years in Burma have the monks been able to travel to each other's monasteries. So that they were very isolated in their own monastery, and you lived in this area, this was your monastery, and you went with this teacher, and that's what you learned, and that's how you did it. And it was kind of like, and they were all slightly different, and they all thought their way was the only way, was the way, the best way, and the only way. And they've begun to be able to travel around now because there's roads and cars and things, and discover, since the British made roads and all in there, that there are various versions of ways to practice. And so it's become much more kind of mixed up. But now you've got, for instance, in Burma, you've got Uttejaniya. I went to practice in his monastery there, which is, you know, his focus is very much open awareness, and just watch when your mind clutches at, you know, the hindrances, when it wants something or doesn't want something or judges something, and the rest, observe the mind. Upandita was very much concentrate, and watch the different states of things coming and going, changing subtlety. And down the road, at the south end of Burma, there's a teacher called Pa'ok, Upa'ok, and he is jhana, deep concentration. Mm-hmm. It's all through deep concentration. Thai is not about concentration at all. It's about living in the moment. So the different and more scholars in Sri Lanka, lots of German scholar monks, lots of studying the suttas, understanding, interpreting the suttas. Not so much an emphasis on the practice, although there's a lot of practice there too. And so there's a different flavors, different pieces of it, all of which we've got bits of here. And people go back and take a while studying with one teacher and learn one particular area and develop that. And so we have, it can be a confusing smorgasbord, but it also, I think, we're very lucky because we can see which parts we're interested in, develop our practice in all these different kinds of ways. It's very much a mix and match. You can end up being a dilettante and, of course, just like forever fiddle with surfacey things, or you can follow something and go far, because they all lead the same way. They all lead freedom. There you go. Goenka was one of the Burmese, came from U Ba Khin, one of the Burmese teachers who thought his was the way. But his way from the suttas was scanning the body, which was an ancient teaching of the Buddha. But his formula of doing it in 10-day retreat and 3 days anapana, the nostril awareness of breath, and then scan the body, he put that together. And then that came to the West as that's the only way to do it. But that they all thought their way was the only way to do it. Well, the benefit with like anything, if you stay with one thing, you develop good skill in that thing, you know, rather than, as I said, be a dilettante, you know, jack of all trades, kind of master of none. So each of them are skillful. You could, you know, go deep with all of them. And so depending on time and your inclination and what, you know, what works for you, then it's really useful to do a lot of concentration. It's really useful to do a lot of open-minded practice. It's really useful to do a lot of metta. You know, they're all useful skills. And so it depends on really who you bump into in your life, what teachers arrive, what practices they offer you that you can, in fact, relate to that work for you. And so there isn't really, I don't have judgment around good or bad or which. It's really accidental in a way, especially as in the West, because we have so many possibilities. That what's working for you and who are your support systems, where is there a group that does this, that works, that you like? As long as the part that matters, that if it's going to be effective, is we have to put ourselves really into them and practice. And if we really practice, whatever the particular skills are, it's all good. You know, it's all great. So I just have the accident of my birth and the teachers who I encountered and what all happened in my way. And it was a boyfriend I met that, you know, taught me. I went off to India and studied with a Sikh guru for 4 years. And here I am, 24 years old, meditating 2.5 hours a day. That was just an accident of being a hippie in a bus and meeting this boyfriend called Mello. I mean, you never know, you know, what will happen. And then his friends, who were these lovely people who were meditators, who were devoted to an Indian guru. Well, I ended up not being devoted to an Indian guru. That was not my thing. But I had learned to sit still for 2.5 hours a day for 3 years. That was, you know, in my 20s. It's extraordinary. You know, so it's just what happens. And then when I had a broken heart and was left carrying the baby, my friend was going to a Goenka retreat. So I went because I was in desperate straits and needed to sit. So I went because she was going. I didn't know anything about Goenka. And so then I got into the whole Goenka scene for 10 years, went to 10 of those retreats. You know, and then I realized, oh, there's other ways of listening to the Dharma. Westerners, oh, wonderful. But it just happened, you know, it's, you don't really... We're not really in charge, I don't think, as much as we like to think. So I'm glad it was for me Theravada and early Theravadan Buddhism, early teachings of the Buddha, because I like about that is that it's not very formulaic and it's very much your own heart and explore your own what leads you to a sense of well-being and spaciousness and groundedness and openness instead of filling it up with your desires and your judgments and your opinions and your, you know, your self-centeredness, and that's not friendly and respectful and free, and that is so practical and so simple. And I'm really glad, because I'm not a good one at following other people's forms. I did one Zen session where somebody was beating a drum and you had to walk in time with the drum in a particular prescribed circle, and I nearly screamed. I was like, that doesn't work for me. I have to do it my way. So, you know. Metta was first taught by the Buddha as a way of extending well-being around and about in order to placate, this is the mythological history, the protective and becoming angry tree spirits, forest spirits, who were irritated because a bunch of monks moved into their forest. They didn't mind the monks initially, but when the monks settled in for the rains retreat, which is 3 months, the tree spirits didn't want them. They're like, oh my God, this is our forest. So they started to spook them out. This is all the mythology. So they started to make horrible smells and noises in the night, and the monks were scared. The Buddha had said, there's a great forest, go there, a good place to you to be protected and settled. There's a village nearby, you'll be able to practice stably. Rains retreat, they weren't on the road, they just stayed put because of the weather. And so he suggested they go to this place. And so they found that they couldn't because it was too creepy and scary and stinky. And so they went back saying, it doesn't work. So the Buddha said, well, if you actually send all this loving kindness to these spirits, and teach them peace and well and happiness and calm, and they won't mind you being there. And so basically, it's not that they're spirits, it's that the monks were insecure being in this particular forest. So you reassure your fear by being kind, and you won't. It's not about spirits, it's that's in your head. And so that was the beginning, and it was a practice in all four directions, north, south, east, west, up and down, kindness, friendliness, well-wishing, and you will find yourself soothed from being afraid. Our basic concern is we're afraid. We're insecure, life is unpredictable. So it was that. It was to stop fear, to antidote fear. And then over the many years, it was practiced through the formulation of the Theravada Buddhism. It was like these phrases. May I feel this, may I feel this, and may I do it. And in there, too, was the formula of myself, my benefactor, my dear friend, a neutral person, a difficult person, all beings to the north, all beings to the east, all beings to the west, beings to the south. It was very formal. And that was brought, that formulaic kind of metta was brought later to the west. Initially, it was meditation without metta. And then the teachers who'd brought practice to the west realized we actually ought to include metta. Metta wasn't practiced that much, I think, in the monasteries of Asia because they didn't actually need it that much. But we, in our post-industrial, unworthiness-diseased society, really need it. As soon as you sit down quietly and you're trying to quiet your mind out, up comes all your, you know, your history of, you know, struggles in your family and all your feelings of shame and all of the stuff that we all have so much because of our society. And so the teachers began to realize we actually ought to add metta. But they only brought, they first started with, may I repeat that formula? And that was in the 90s that I encountered that, and I had a hard time with that. Again, it was way too, like, rote for me. It didn't work for me at all. In fact, it made me feel inadequate. I didn't have benefactors. I didn't like myself. You know, I was like, I just got wound up about it. So I used to ignore it for the longest time. And then I began actually practicing teaching. And so then I began to do it my own way. And so there's a million ways. And finally, now, I was a bit of a pioneer in alternative metta, I have to say, in the teaching body here in North America. And now there's all kinds of creative mettas coming along. So, because it's just about being kind and being friendly. It used to be the word loving kind. Metta was translated loving kindness. Well, loving is a big flash. You know, it's like, oh, you've got to be really loving. Well, that gets all tangled up with attachment. It gets all tangled up with connection. It gets all tangled up with expectation. It gets all tangled up with sex, with being looking good. There's a lot of, I use the word friendliness, as you can hear. And so, like, that's, it's much more, it's less Hollywood. You know, it's just to be friendly. How can we be friendly? Empathy is friendly. Compassion is friendly. Receiving is friendly. Offering is friendly. Generosity is friendly. You know, it's easy to, wishing well can easily get, like, I want you to feel better. Why aren't you feeling better? You know, things like that. So there's a lot, it's a big topic and a beautiful area to explore. And so, but it's essential for us to reassure ourselves because of our anxiety. So we do need, but we need to find our own ways. It's an art, I think, rather than a technique. And so we need to find our own ways, whether it's through gratitude or beauty or generosity or forgiveness or, you know, spaciousness, you know, whatever it is, soothing, respecting ourselves in different ways, which allow the heart to be more at ease. And then the mind will be able to calm down, because we're most of us fairly upset. Robin. Well, it's hard to say, just because depending on you, your situation, you know, what kind of mind you have. For early practitioners, newer practitioners, I really like Buddhism Without Beliefs. It's written by Stephen Batchelor. I think he's just such a great writer, for one thing. He's an English workman, and so he uses the English language so expressively, and it's so helpful. Buddhism Without Beliefs, Stephen Batchelor. Mindfulness in Plain English is also a really good introductory book. It's Bhante Gunaratana. He's a Sri Lankan monk who lives in West Virginia. He's been here many years. Who says, by the way, I won't teach Westerners any form of practice until they've done 3 years of metta, because you need it. Which is an interesting comment from an Asian. There's so many books. The Path with Heart has been a tried and true favorite for many people for a long time. Jack Kornfield. Jack has got now a lot of online stuff. You can go Jack Kornfield and then you'll get onto his own website. And he's got very good, thorough courses to take online. He's doing a lot of that now. He's got a very good speaking voice and very compassionate man. And that's useful for beginning people. And there's so many books that I don't read or haven't read. Oh, there's just millions of books. I would do those to begin with.
What was the last one?
Jack Kornfield, Path with Heart. It's not that new. And then the mindfulness, the base for mindfulness, was one of the Theravadan students who was doing, he'd done a lot of practice, John Kabat-Zinn, and he started mindfulness-based stress reduction. And he's got the book that's really the foundation for all of that, which is called Full Catastrophe Living. Brilliant book, because it's got the program of 8 weeks, how you gradually apply mindfulness to the stress of being a Western person.
I have a question about noticing. I notice when I have like aversion or grasping, and I'm starting to notice a little bit like when something's pleasant and unpleasant, so that I don't kind of go to that point where I'm grasping. Can you talk anything about?
That's great practice. That's a great practice, Jean Marie. So this is the first foundation of mindfulness is the body, awareness of the body in different ways, in movements, in posture, you know, in sensations, in elemental ways of feeling its weight and its softness and so on. All fascinating and great, even as it dies and so on. So body. And then the second foundation of four foundations is Vedana, as you just mentioned, which is means the quality of moments experience for each of us. They have either pleasant quality, unpleasant quality, or in between. I'm using in between. It's not like not pleasant and unpleasant, but less pleasant and somewhat unpleasant. So there's a big continuum in between. And so if we do that, as you just described, if we can be aware of the quality of our experience, doesn't mean it's inherent in that experience and everyone will feel the same thing about it, but every moment we do experience one of these somewhere in this continuum. If we can notice that, we will notice, we will see how the pleasant is what triggers the wanting, and the unpleasant is what triggers the resistance or struggle, and the in-between is what actually triggers seagull response, which is, oh, it's just seagulls. Who cares? That response of disconnect, not bothering with, not paying attention, numbing out. And so if we can, hey, as a practice, but if we practice like that, is this pleasant, is this unpleasant, or is it in between, we can then see when we do, that's what that is, and this is what I am, how am I with it? We'll see the connection. When it's pleasant, I want. When it's unpleasant, I don't, I resist. When it's in between, I dull down. And we can see how, if we are aware of the quality of the moment, we'll see that, we'll see that relationship. And watching that, we won't be all lost in, I want, this is awful. We'll see, oh, it's unpleasant, my system is rejecting it. That's what's actually going on. It's not just that it's not okay. It's there's a relationship that's triggering my behavior. And then when we see that, we aren't so already lost in the tangle. We're seeing that there's a relationship going on. There's a situation taken as unpleasant, triggering judgment or fear. When we see the behavior as a behavior, because of that, those two things, we'll catch ourselves before we're already off in complaining and whining. So it's a brilliant thing.
Sometimes I can be sitting and hear a truck go by really loud, or hear someone using a weed eater or something, and it can be unpleasant, and I can have like a reaction. And sometimes I can hear the same sound, but it's like, well, I don't particularly like it, but you know, I'm just sitting there.
That's because what you're doing is you're practicing with Vedana, which is the unpleasant or pleasant or neither quality of that moment, and you're observing it rather than identifying with it. When you're observing it, you're also observing your response to it, and you're seeing that your response changes. It's still the same sound, and you're seeing, oh, unpleasant, I don't like it. Oh, that's a way of seeing. Oh, and now I'm not seeing it that way, and now there isn't that response. By looking at the quality, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither, or in between, and being able to practice enough how you are with it, you'll see that apparently the sound changes. But it's your response that's changing. And so even though we aren't saying, look at your response, we may say it, you're able to see by being present enough how our relationship keeps changing. That's a very key realization, because it's your relationship to things which makes you happy or not. It's not the thing. And so when you can see, oh, I'm liking it, now I'm not, now I don't mind it, or now I'm not, you know, I don't like it, and now actually I'm tolerating it, you're seeing how flexible your happiness actually is. And that's the key to awakening, because when we're awakening, we're not caught in having to have it be different because we don't like it or we like it.
So when if I notice it, it's like, well, I don't really like the sound of a truck going by, but it doesn't bother me that much. I don't have to label it as unpleasant or pleasant. It can be neutral without it being that I'm just ignoring it.
You don't have to do it. Exactly. And we start seeing all the in-between nuanced thing, quality things, but we're not hooked in having to do anything, which means the sense of self isn't activated. And the dukkha of having a sense of self who has to do something isn't activated. There's just awareness noticing sounds and able to recognize the tendency to make something of them, judge them, and get involved or not. And you're watching. And that's what we're trying to do in practicing, is watching the sense of self arise and get its teeth into something because it doesn't like it or it likes it. And then it doesn't have to do that. You're seeing the sense of self arising and relaxing, arising and relaxing. And the awareness is just noticing all that.
So sometimes I hear the same sound and it's like, it's just there, that's fine. And then other times, I start getting really judgmental about the neighbor and
that's right.
It all worked out.
That's right.
And then something I started doing a little bit is keeping myself metta and then metta, because it's like, whoa,
yes.
I'm so triggered so easily.
That's right. That's really wise. All of that's really wise practice, because you see that we don't always have the same response. It's an immediate experiential. Life is experience. Life isn't like proscribed by plan. And so, you know, you meet the moment, and how are you meeting that moment, and how is your system responding in that moment, and you're seeing. And at times it's spaciousness and it's all okay. At other times it's like, judge the neighbor and hate the neighbor and going to lecture the neighbor and realizing, oh, that's so painful, and that's what war is made out of. And then having compassion for the fact that you responded that way. it wasn't you did it, it's that your mind believed that we should blame the neighbor and then you'd feel better and then you wouldn't have to put up with that noise. And that's just the way of coping with the sound. And you see, that's what practicing reveals, how we get entangled in relating to our world, trying to make it be what we think it should be or not needing to try and allowing it to be as it is. And so that's distressing for ourselves, and it also is conflictive. And that's how we get into conflict, because of misseeing that the neighbor is an enemy when actually it's just them cleaning something up or something. And so metta then can mitigate, because it's like, oh, right, well, compassion practice is all part of the metta thing, because now there's some understanding again. Oh, yes, I was taking a position, I was judging, I then was going to behave in a way that would be... So that's what practice does. It reveals the patterning. It reveals the relating. It reveals then what happens. And then you get to see by being present, if I were to act on that thought, that feeling, and then that thought, then that word, then say that, then my relationship with my neighbor would be thus. And that's how sects are born. And that's how, you know, nationalism happens on. You know, you see the making of our world through the mind, through the state of the mind. And that's what the Buddha is trying to teach us. And we do it by simply being in your body, in the present moment, with your breath. And then you start realizing what's going on, actually.
And so if something is neutral, I don't have to go, well, it's kind of pleasant.
No. You don't have to work so hard.
Okay. No.
It's just what it is. Yeah. You know, what basically, you want to know, am I at ease? Am I present, clear, open, grounded? My heart's peaceful? Engage, you know, or am I triggered into some kind of got to do something, you know, and how do you recognize when you're triggered? There's a kind of, for me, I get boxed in, it starts whirling inside, there's a kind of revving up, got to do something about something, and it's unpleasant. And I can see it quickly, and then it's in here. For me, it's all in here. The tension is in here, and the noise is some motor feeling in here, and I tend to go, whoop, that's my nature. I don't go, I'm an Aries. And we all do it differently. You know, some people, my son is like, oh, immediately he goes to the big view. He goes, when anything's occurring, he's like, okay, who's doing what? What's going on? He's a 9 on the Enneagram. We have our ways, you know. But recognizing how that is. And I've recognized mine goes like this. And I was telling you about the bucket last night. It's like, oh, I don't need to go there. I don't need to push into life. And that all you learn by being able to be present enough to see all that. So you're just seeing, which is Vipassana. Yeah, so you don't have to try too hard. Once you're able, the trying has to be in the early stages to be able to stay here, to be present, and then all these things I'm teaching this weekend to help ourselves be able to stay. As we stay, that's the goal. Stay present, seeing, insight, or Vipassana, seeing inside, only hums when we're steadily able to keep seeing. As you keep seeing in a stable way, which clearly you do, you see all these patternings of what your mind does and how it creates your well-being and the world's well-being, or doesn't, gets in the way of it. And that all just continues revealing. The job and where we have to work is to get here and to stay here. A steady gaze. And so, and that's the beginning part of practicing. Steady gaze. Yes. You don't have to pull yourself back. First of all, it's not yourself. It's just the mind. And that's what the mind does. It's wriggling around and trying to fix. That's its job. It's doing a great job. It doesn't work that well, but, you know, thank you very much. It's fine for shopping, but it's not fine for happiness and health. And right. Okay. So thank you. You don't have to blame yourself. Okay. So then you begin to stay with the skills I'm teaching you. So then you get a little more steady. You relax. You calm down. It's all very uninspiring, right? Just sitting here. It's not busy. So we become duller. So then the refining, I was talking about it yesterday, this is a really useful template, this template. So over and over we say these things. There are one on top of the other. I see them like that, as one on top of the other. These two templates, the Buddha taught lists as ways to actually understand what's going on. They're just ways. Each one is like a different template or a set of lenses. So there's the hindrances set of lenses, which when we're not calm and present and open and friendly and all free from distress, we're in. And we're often in two or three or four at a time. We can't be in all. Two are wanting and not wanting, and they can be going simultaneously. I want this because I don't want that. Right there, back to back. We could be agitated and stressed out, squirmy and all over the place, or we can be dull and sinking. We can't be both at once. We can be wanting, not wanting, and dull, wanting, not wanting, and agitated all at once. And then there's doubt. There's a whole topic, and I'm not going to talk about it. Another weekend, I'll come up and talk about that. We'll explore doubt. It's huge. When we don't trust that the things are as they are, or that they're doable as they are, we show up into doing something. The self motivate, all of this is selfing, but the doubt really is the big one underneath the others, and very lurky and sneaky and very convincing that it's right. Okay, so that template, get to know the template, particularly in terms of agitation and dullness. Recognize those in your experience. Okay, now then underneath is this other template, which are the awakened actors. Those are the, what the opposite of awakening is, asleeping factors. These are awakening factors. Seven, mindfulness is the first one, meaning present awareness. So that goes without saying. Then there are three and three. The three activating, energizing, uplifting, and the three soothing, calming, and settling. If your hindrance is agitation, you need the calming three. If your hindrance, which it is often, is dullness, you need the activating three. So put them as one, those three. They are separate, but he taught them in seven. They're actually different, but they are related. Activating is interest, persistence, and kind of like up for it, enthusiasm, and a gentle enthusiasm and delight, which is part of enthusiasm. It's like, this is neat stuff. What's going on here? This curiosity, this connection. Those are the activating of energy. The soothing ones are serenity, collectedness, so the mind actually will do what you want to do and not do what it wants to do. It'll stay here if you want it to. It'll be really open and steady gaze if you want it to, whatever. It's like a, and balanced, not triggered into reactivity. Those are the calm three. If you're agitated, you want a lot of serenity, calm, relax. If you're dull and sleepy, too much of the relax, you want curiosity, delight, and just energy up for it. So what enthuses you? Then you ask the questions. Getting dull, you ask the questions, why am I sitting here? What is it about meditation that matters to me? And how much do I care about it? I really care about it. These are values to me because I want my life to be based on honesty and based on clarity and based on kindness, not based on getting and judging and falling asleep. Okay, and what's, you know, and how is my body right now? So then you start asking the odd time question, which brings up the energy. But the idea is to do it before you're asleep. Because if you're really asleep, you're like, what was I supposed to ask? You know? So it's as you get duller, then get brighter. You know, sit up straighter, take some breaths, open your eyes, do something different, be kind to yourself, reflect on the goodness that is in you, count a few blessings, like, re-enthuse yourself about having an inner life that's got good quality. Right. And then you're brighter again, and you won't fall asleep. So that's the skill. That's the fine skill of meditating in a balanced, energetic way. Bright enough, not too agitated. Calm enough, not too dull. And that's where the actual working of being present is. Exactly. And that's because we're not so skilled yet, which we do. When you're riding a bicycle, you're either gritting your teeth and holding your breath and white knuckles, or you're crashing on the gravel. Whereas as we get better, we're able to ride without even hands. It's just a learning of fineness. And that just comes with practice. Can't do it wrong. It's lunchtime. Quick one.
It just brings up a question that I've had about what we're doing with our minds or words, silent words in our heads while we're meditating. And I think it can be easy, or at least I'll just speak for me. I felt like And times I've thought, okay, I should not have any words ever during meditating. That's good.
Not true.
And then, and so, but because I think I could do something in my mind that's got some words in it or whatever, and it might feel helpful, but then I can, like, what's the, you know, for me, it's like sometimes what's the line between words that are
yes.
helping me be present and
right.
words that are going off into,
right.
you know, what
well, so
on.
You yourself need to know that, what's your name?
Jeff,
you're right. You need to know yourself when you're present and when you're off. And that's the first thing we really need to keep recognizing. When there's mindfulness and when we're actually, there's a knowing that we're here and we're in the present moment and our ears work and our we can feel the earth and we know that we're, you know, in this room and all of the sort of the brightness of being present needs to be present. And we need to keep recognizing when it's there, when it's not there, when it's there. But we can't recognize when it's not there because we're not there to recognize.
Yeah.
But when we're present again, we can okay, now this is present awareness. So it's all by experience. So chatter, 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 comment, I, noise in the brain, it goes on most of the time for most people. What we learn, though, is not to believe it. The problem is believing in it. That storyteller is narrating what's going on, and your neighbor is an idiot, and you're an idiot. Well, that's not true. That's just comment. So we need to withdraw our attention from it. Not to try and stop it or think it shouldn't be there or anything around it. It just, it's the busy little executive assistant doing her thing, you know, it's just telling you how it is and, you know, you want to watch out for this person, they're a creep, you know. And so you just tolerate that and you stay more simply in the present moment. And then with even relax or come here, that's using that verbal thing in a way that actually is supportive of you not getting all carried away with stories and judgments and thought trains.
So it sounds like
use your mind rather than be used by your mind.
Right. Well, use my sense of know, like I definitely know when I'm present and
right.
know when I've not been present.
Right.
And
right.
So it's
so enhance the being present, make more of it. The same when we're distracted or we're troubled or we're upset, we're caught in something, and then we're not, make more of the not. We tend to go for the next problem or the next issue or the next because that's the way we're wired. With the little executive assistant thinks that's meaningful. Abide fully when you're present, when you're quiet, when it's ordinary, when there's no stimulation and no threat. Just like, oh, okay. Really fully live in those moments that we've been missing. Give yourself to just the simplicity of this moment fully. Like, give our hearts, engage ourselves in the things that we thought weren't useful and disengage from the things that we thought were useful, which are getting and getting rid of. It's the opposite. That's why the Buddha said this is called going against the stream. It's like taking a bowl and throwing it in the river and watching it go upstream. No one's going to get it. It's not because it's hard. It's because it's going the opposite way than the little mind wants to go. That's why we have to practice. And now we have to have